If somebody asks me a question, even if it's like very personal to me, I'll be honest, because I'm really big on trust, because the more honest you are with your team, the more honest they're going to be with you. And that element of trust is so important for everything around work and trusting each other. And so I really like building that up by being honest in return with people.
Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast for engineering leaders, where Iso Kent and Jason Warner share their lessons on the ins and outs of managing software teams. Today, we have Alexandra Sunderland on the podcast. Alexandra is a senior engineering manager at Fellow App and the author of Remote Engineering Management, Managing an Engineering Team in a Remote First World. Alexandra joins us to talk about creating a good remote work foundation and the challenges of jumping back into in-person interactions when needed. The guys also chatted about how remote emotions translate to in-person ones, segmenting emotional reactions, wearing different masks, and more. As always, this episode comes with accompanying show notes, with a deep dive into the main topics, mental models, and key moments from this episode. Find them at developingleadership.co and linked in the episode description. Developing
Leadership. Hi, everyone. We're back again with yet another episode of Developing Leadership. Jason and I have a fantastic guest with us today, Alexandra Sunderland. Alexandra is a senior engineering manager at Fellow.app, and we invited her on after we saw that she wrote the book called Remote Engineering Management, Managing an Engineering Team in a Remote First World. I personally really enjoyed it. It's highly practical and is one of those books that gives you direct advice with the context behind it. And so, yeah, big welcome, Alexandra. Glad to have you on with us here today.
Hi, thanks. I'm excited to be here.
So when we had a little chat before the podcast, you mentioned that you were listening to an episode that we did a while back with Michael Lopp, where he advocated for, you know, in person is the best. So I'm kind of curious, you know, you had a strong reaction to that. I'm curious to hear a little bit more and if you agree with that statement or not at all.
Yeah, so I think when I was listening to that, I was driving my car down the road and heard him talk about how in-person one-on-ones and in-person calls are, or meetings are better because you get a better sense of the person and their body language. And there's something that feels so fake about doing a call with them. And I thought like, what? No, I totally disagree. When you're having calls remotely, there's something that ends up being more genuine about that. And like, yes, seeing the person on your screen makes that person feel maybe a bit like an avatar and you can tell that they're not real. But in my experience, just having a call with someone makes the things that you're saying more real. It's kind of like that phenomenon where you're sitting next to someone staring in the same direction. So maybe like sitting in a car driving together or on a bench talking. The conversations you have, you're able to open up more than normal and you say things that are deeper and say things that are maybe a little trickier to say and more emotionally loaded. But those conversations that happen are just so important. And I find I get that same feeling when I'm doing remote calls with people, especially in one-on-ones, because you don't get the kind of like imposing physical presence of having someone sitting across the table from you in a meeting room, like staring at you with fluorescent lights while you're trying to maybe open up about something that's hard to talk about. I feel so comfortable sitting in my office at home right now. I don't have to look at anyone straight in the eye. I can like look around the room and it doesn't feel uncomfortable that we're not making eye contact. And I can like have a blanket with me and nobody can tell. And I can fidget with everything on my desk. And having those little things just makes people feel more comfortable. So I really think that having remote calls has this, it brings more humanness to it because it's easier to talk about difficult things and really say what's on your mind without that physical imposing presence.
You're the first person I've heard say it this clearly. And I think the analogy that you draw, the comparison to the drive in the car with someone where you're, is to me one of the best ones. It's the first time I've heard it, but it's one of the best ones I can think of. And it makes a lot of sense. Actually, what you're saying resonates a lot with me. And if I think about the meetings that I have, it definitely holds true. Curious to get your thoughts here, Jason.
Well, I think essentially what it comes down to, I do think, is that everyone has personal preferences, and preferences are different across the board. So I tend to think, I've been doing this 13 years now, I tend to think that I like the remote stuff more, primarily because it's efficient. I get to jump around to meetings, and I force myself to be very good with the human interactions. I like some of the in-person stuff when it comes to groups much more than I like doing this on Zooms or video for groups. Individuals, I find that the remote stuff is way easier, way better. There's no difference between connecting as to a human video remote versus in the room in person. But as a group, I tend to like to do it more in person. But again, it comes down to personal preference. And again, we even had this conversation in the pre-episode for the recording here. And I've talked about this. And Alexandra, I'm sure that you've had conversations on this too. In-person remote is not really the conversation. It feels like stage, context, purpose, all those are the real conversations that we need to end up having. And anyone who thinks that remote is not a thing, I mean, they're just kidding themselves. Any company over 150 people is effectively a remote company. You've got to communicate. You've got to figure out. You've got to organize yourselves in a way that makes it efficient for you to be able to communicate to people across even the city. And I joked about this. Salesforce, when I was at Heroku, had a policy of, you know, we wanted all these people to be in the buildings and in Salesforce towers and stuff. No one ever left their desks. Everyone stayed there and did Zoom calls or meetings all day. And there was no way that you were being, you know, four floors away from each other and go to a meeting in person. You were going to take that from a meeting room on your floor or at your desk. So ostensibly, everyone's a remote company once you pass a certain size, no matter what, anyway.
There's something that I would add to this, and I'm not sure if I've spoken about it on the podcast before, but I know you and I have had this conversation, Jason, is to me what I value a lot about remote communication, which I don't hear a lot of people talking about, is how deliberate you can be. And what I mean by that is, you know, you can have slept really bad the night before, or you might just come from a conversation like another meeting that was incredibly tough, but you can kind of reset, right? Like you can get before you open that Zoom link, you reset, you set your frame of mind for that specific conversation that you're about to have. Since it's time boxed, you know I have to be in this set frame of mind for the next 30 minutes. If that's bringing, what is it, you know, Frank Slootman amping it up, bringing excitement like to a meeting that you really know like it's going to help drive it, or if it be far more like thoughtful or focused on the person. And you know that you have to turn it on for exactly 30 minutes. And it's not disingenuous, because I don't think it is, but it's deliberate, right? You're there and you're exactly in that frame of mind. And then you turn it off and maybe you turn around and you're, you know, joking with your partner, or you're going to take a nap because you're exhausted. And like, you know, you couldn't do that in an office, because if you're doing that in an office, like how you feel will shine through the moment you leave that room, and it becomes disingenuous. And that's maybe the weird part that I'm trying to figure out. Like if you're deliberate, are you actually not disingenuous? Well, if you were deliberate in real life, you would come across quite disingenuous if you walk out that meeting room and now joke all of a sudden with someone on the floor when you just had a serious conversation. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, Alexander.
Yeah, I've actually started running into that quite a bit recently, because so I've been working remotely for the last 10 years, but in the last month, we've gotten an office to go to downtown for whoever wants to go. It's not forced, but I have been very excited about the thought of going into an office for the first time in my career. So I've been making use of that. And I got caught up in this thing where I'm so used to just like showing all of my emotions at home because nobody can see me. And so I'm fine like reacting to Slack messages and reacting to meetings and stuff. But I'm having to learn how to rein that in when I'm at the office, because I'll go to a meeting and if something upsetting happened or some bad news was shared, I'll walk back to my desk and very clearly be in such a bad mood where people message me saying, "Are you okay?" And I have to learn like not to do that. And that takes a lot of energy, especially if you're feeling stressed about something. And like you said, it affects how the rest of the team is doing, and they'll see that you're not in a great mood, and that kind of brings everything down. So I'm trying really hard to not do that. But working remotely, it's great being able to segment those emotions into like time boxes on the calendar almost, especially if maybe I had one-on-ones back to back where awful news was shared in one. And then immediately after that, I had to hang up the call and go to a next one where incredible news was shared. And I had to react appropriately in both situations and not be like sad in one and happy in the other when it wasn't appropriate. And if that was happening in person, it'd be kind of awkward, because if the sad person saw how happy I was, then they're going to think I'm not like taking their news seriously. But I don't want to like give away that they gave sad info. Like it's just so hard to deal with like absorbing all those emotions and figuring out how to display it. So it's really tough. And it is hard because I, especially in the office, like if I'm feeling a certain way, like, yeah, like you said, it can feel disingenuous to not actually put that on display and to hide it. But I am always up for like telling people what's going on. Like if there's something that is important for them to know and like something bad is happening that they should be aware of, I'm all for that. But I definitely think that in some situations it makes sense to kind of keep it to yourself because you don't want to negatively affect everybody else when it's not necessary.
I find that exactly what you said, Alexandra, is true. One of the things I've noted, if you want to be good at what you're doing remote and particularly over video, is you tend to have to be more expressive, you know, because you're lacking some physical connection in the room. So you have to use your hands more, you have to use your head more, your facial expressions are much more important, your tonal inflections are much more important. So you tend to use those as the tools that you have in a remote setting, when in fact, when you're in the office, you're trying to tamp a lot of those things down. Even in normal course of business, you're trying to use one mode exclusively. If you're in a meeting, it's the duck on the pond analogy, which is like you might be spinning below the water, but you're calm above it, or you're trying to show frustration because of the way the meeting's going. But it's one or maybe a possibly two modes in person, whereas you're trying to use them all in a remote setting. So you have to actually understand how to, you know, it's like, an actor trying to throw on several different accents. You've got to be able to use them appropriately in different settings. But ISO, to your point, I've actually thought about this a lot because we had this conversation ourselves, you and I, a long time ago. And I realized for me why it worked with the context switchings and the framing at home. And it's because I think of this box, the computer, as the segment. But I think of the office, the entire office, as the segmentation. So I'm able to switch because of the box, the computer, but I don't get to switch in and out of it at the office until I actually leave the office, which is why I think so many people, when they're physically located in an office, say, let's go for a walk, let's get out of the building, let's do that sort of thing, because they're probably very similar, which is the entire office, however many floors, whatever you consider to be your office, is the segmentation.
That's so true. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that the times where things are getting crazy at work. I'll go outside on a walk, get a coffee, just leave. And it gives you a new frame of mind. And same at home. Like if I need a break, I'll just leave this room that I'm working in and go like lie down on the bed, go to the couch, do whatever. And anytime I enter this room, like I feel like this is where work happens. This is where I feel a certain way.
I noticed it with me when I had another computer over here. And I literally, all I had to do is switch from this computer to that computer. And it reset me enough to come back. But I do think of this office as sacrosanct in that way. It's like, all right, I'm going to go sit on the couch out in the living room for just 3 minutes. 3 minutes. That's all I need over there, you know?
I know exactly the feeling you have. Do either of you, by the way, when you've been so remote this long, and for me, it's now, I don't know, going on 6 years, something like this. It's been COVID, of course, for many of us was an example, but even post COVID, that's even something you can say. I started having a couple of in-person meetings again, but not frequently enough that I'm no longer awkward in them. I actually find myself quite awkward in person these days. And it's not something how most people would have described me like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I realized that like I take a second because I'm actually not looking people in the eyes anymore. And I'm kind of wandering all over the place, or like, is this just a me thing, or is it something you, Jason, you've started having in-person meetings? Alexandra, you just started going to an office.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that. It's very weird, especially because of the whole, like, do you bring a laptop situation? Like, how do you sit? Do you face each other? Are you an angle? Everything. So I find that meetings with groups of people are fine. Like those are a little bit easier to do, especially if you're like working on a project together and there's like some goal and you know exactly what you're going to talk about. The ones that are harder are that I struggled a lot with at first is one-on-ones where you're sitting next to someone, you stand up at the same time, walk together to some room, sit down facing each other, and then like, what do you talk about? The hard thing for me especially is just because I find like before, whenever I'd go into an office when I was working remotely to see people there, I wouldn't have a laptop because technology is like a distraction and you don't want that in meetings. And so for one-on-ones now, I've been struggling with like, well, we have this whole agenda on our laptop, like in Fellow. Do we sit here staring at each other with our laptops open? How do we know what time it is? Like, how do we know when the meeting's over? When do we go back? Like, I don't want to be, because if I don't have my laptop open, I don't want to be checking my watch every 5 minutes, and I can't set like an alarm or something, because then I'm going to be checking my phone and who knows if it's a call or an email or whatever that's buzzing. And so I found that part really stressful, because having a laptop open in front of just one person when you're talking about personal things and one-on-one type stuff is weird. It's good because, you know, in one-on-ones you should have agendas and things you're talking about and taking notes about whatever is going on, but it's definitely something I'm still getting used to and haven't really found the right way of doing just yet.
ISO and I have talked about this a lot in person in the past, and I think we might have mentioned this in the podcast. I have not found the awkwardness personally, mostly because I have for many years thought of most social interactions as masks that I put on. And it, for me, when it comes to post-COVID, again, if we can say such a thing, it's just kind of like slipping on a mask. And so, yeah, it was like maybe a little dusty the first couple of times I put it on, but it was something that I had to practice for years anyway. So it was kind of, you know, the riding the bike scenario. You just, you know, and my mode of doing it was, you know, slight bit of humor, slight bit of seriousness, but not taking myself too seriously, get into the mode, like, et cetera, et cetera. There's like a rhythm to one-on-one meetings that most people know if they've had one with me. And the first couple of times might have been slightly awkward as you get to it, but like 85% of it was still the normal one. And then now it's just back to old hat.
I was just going to say, I'm excited to get to that point where it's past the peak awkwardness and everything's normal.
So are we actually genuine when we do this? I know I'm going a little bit deeper than our than the usual podcast, although we've been doing this lately a little bit more. When we're putting on these masks, or when we're being deliberate, or when we're knowing, hey, I'm showing up to this meeting and I should use a little bit of humor and I should, like, you know, tone it down here, or like, are we being good leaders? Are we being genuine? Like, where is the line versus I'm making that other person feel comfortable enough in the situation that they're in, kind of like, you know, why human beings smile in certain cultures and might not smile in others? Or are we kind of getting to the point where we're actually just starting to be a little bit like the way we'll probably end up training our avatars one day, like, in this situation, this is what you're supposed to show? And I'm kind of curious, Alexandra, you talk a lot about communication in your book. Where do you think that line lies?
That's a good question. I tend to veer on the side of being very, very open and transparent with people. And it's very infrequently that I'll like put on a veil of like, this is my like persona for this or that, or I'll like try to mask like I know I talked earlier about like masking emotions when like news has been shared and I don't want to affect the team. I think that's kind of the limit of where it goes for me. And if somebody asks me question, even if it's like very personal to me, I'll be honest, because I'm really big on trust, because the more honest you are with your team, the more honest they're going to be with you. And that element of trust is so important for everything around work and trusting each other. And so I really like building that up by being honest in return with people.
Do you find yourself, if I think about my company, we've managed to meet in person once since we founded almost 3 years ago, and we'll soon meet again for a second time. And I got COVID 24 hours in. So I had about 24 hours with the team in person. And I realized that in those 24 hours with the team, I shared more personal things about my life than I probably did in the whole 2.5 years before. Because the moment you're outside of that time box constraint, you keep talking. Right, like, I know it sounds sound like we're robots here, but like, you know, like, do you find yourself that now you're coming into the office that there's more room for sharing that personal side, or do you think it's important for a manager to make room in their, like, you know, remote interactions to go into the personal as well? And how do you think how do you recommend someone successfully doing that?
Yeah, I think it's very important to make time for that working remotely as well. And especially so for my situation, it's not like my entire team is going into the office together and we all get to be there all the time. It's only a handful of people that are going in, and I don't want to exclude anyone who's working remotely, because when I was working remotely before, it was the entire company in an office together and I'm the one single remote person who's not involved. So I know very much how it feels to be not included in certain discussions. And so I think that the time to talk and make connections as humans kind of needs to be built into the workday, not forced. Like I'm not a huge fan of saying like, this is the hour where we're all going to play video games together. And just like forced fun is never fun for anyone. I don't like it. But what I've landed on, I've gone through many iterations of this. Like in 2020, when everyone first started working from home, we had a bad iteration where every single day at 10 a.m., we were all working in the same time zone. But every single day at 10 a.m., we'd have like a half hour stand up type thing where we just like get on a call, chat, see how everyone's doing. That didn't last very long because every single day is ridiculous and nobody starts at the same time. And it's the worst way of doing it. But what we've landed on now that I really like is each engineering team has a twice weekly half hour meeting that's social time. And so we don't call a stand up. We don't do anything work related in it unless there's something super urgent that people need help with right away. And it's like a half asynchronous, half synchronous meeting where we have a note for it and everyone kind of jots down, this is what I'm thinking of working on today. Not traditional stand up type stuff, but just getting some work stuff out there. And then the call itself is just talking about what we did on the weekend, what we're going to be doing later, like what we just talk about life. And people bring fun icebreaker questions sometimes, like some of those, like, you know, would you rather fight a duck or a horse size, that one, those kinds of things. But yeah, so we have a lot of time built in for making social connections there. And then we do end up having in-person meetups as well. We do those 3 times a year because we're spread across the world now. And it makes those even nicer because you're not spending the time getting to know each other as people and like building up those outside of work relationships. You already have a good foundation. And so you're able to just jump right in and be like, hey, how's your wife doing? Let's go like get a coffee. And it's just more natural feeling to jump right into that.
You mentioned something in your book, and I think it's in bold if I remember correctly, which is you're not responsible for your team members' personal lives. You're only responsible for them at work. Empathy massively matters as a leader. And like you said, you're sharing a lot about your life, and that opens up often the gateway for people to do the same. And I personally think having a strong relationship where both sides feel very comfortable to share what's happening in their lives builds for a great foundation for people working together. I think separating those things becomes, if it's only ever about work, it's hard to build that strength of a relationship. There's a boundary somewhere in terms of, you know, how involved and where not. And I know you talk about this in your book, and I'm kind of curious to get your thoughts and curious to hear, you know, yours following on that, Jason.
Yeah, this was something that I thought was really important to point out because it's something that I've struggled with and I've seen a lot of other people struggle with as well. Because as a manager, you talk to so many people and you're responsible for the work of so many people, and you do end up learning a lot about people's personal lives. And inevitably, something awful will happen to someone, sometimes multiple people at the same time. And if you're a manager, you probably are an empathetic person already, but that stuff will weigh really heavily on you. And you can't really push it aside. It's not something that is just contained to work. And, you know, like I feel awful for so many things that are going on for people all the time. But our natural instinct, I think, as managers, especially engineering managers, is to try to problem solve, because that's kind of the default. Like, you know, there's a problem, we're engineers, we'll solve it. Like, this is something we can do. But you can't do that for people's personal lives. There are things you can do to try to make work easier for them and maybe make accommodations, make some changes to how things are going. But I think it's really important to just remember that you can't and you should not try to solve people's lives outside of work. It is not your job. You're not a parent. You're not involved in their lives that way. It's nice that people are sharing things with you so you can help at work specifically. But yeah, I have to remind myself sometimes, like, not to feel like I'm powerless over a situation, because it is not my role to fix these things.
I mean, this is a topic that's kind of come up in various different forms for the last 10 or so years, particularly in Silicon Valley. And one thing I try to reinforce, and I had to learn this myself too, is that you have to separate those things, exactly as Alexandra was saying. And, you know, you've got to, the easiest way for me to say this is essentially what she said too, which is you've got to make accommodations. So, you know, if something incredibly hard comes up in someone's personal life, you can say, okay, essentially take whatever time you need, you know, if it's at an extreme end of a spectrum, to get this sorted out and figure it out and, you know, come back, et cetera, when you're ready. We'll talk in the meantime. But that's essentially setting up the stage for them to take care of that thing in their life and to do that. And you to say, this is how we're going to react to this with you. We're going to give you the space and the time so you can focus your energies and efforts. And if you need something from specifically from work, whether it be from an insurance perspective or something like that, HR is over here. They can handle some of those things with you. You can't take that stuff on and you can't help them with that too. And I push this really hard is you're not trained to do that. You don't have not learned to do this. So for instance, there's a you know, sub vein inside Silicon Valley where people will talk about, I don't want to use this word too loosely because people have various degrees of feelings, but like bring yourself to work and all those sorts of things. But like, let's say you're bringing like, you know, some sort of emotional trauma to work and talking about it on your one-on-ones on a regular basis. In my view, that's completely inappropriate to like, for me as an engineering manager to engage with somebody. I'll say, hey, what accommodations do I need to make for you to sort this out? I'm not capable of having that conversation with you to a degree I feel comfortable. You can have that with me and say, this is like why my work product is not where it needs to be, et cetera, blah, 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 all the different caveats. But I can't engage with you like a therapist would or a psychologist would or anybody would. In fact, I think it's completely inappropriate. But for some reason, we've seemed to maybe, you know, to some degree or percentage in the engineering management culture say, this is one of the types of conversations we should be having. I feel so strongly the opposite. I think we'd be doing people a disservice to do that.
Alexandra, when we had a chat earlier, you spoke about hiring, because we talk a lot about, and we did already today as well, about, you know, remote and the setting of remote at the office. But what about our hiring processes? And you said some very interesting things that I'd love for you to kind of share with the audience and on how you think about them.
Yeah. So when people are starting to get into hiring, normally people will go through this sort of training where you learn how to ask questions, how to talk to people, and questions not to ask and biases to look out for. And I think that when we're interviewing people remotely, there's this whole new set of biases that people aren't talking about, but they're super important. And interviewing people remotely gives you insight into so many new signals that you don't get to see when you're interviewing people in person. So for example, if you're talking to someone on a call, you can see their background and they might have like a messy bed behind them or a bunch of dishes, or, you know, you can see their house, and that can give you insight into like their socioeconomic status. If they clean their house, like things like that. Internet quality is also something that gives insight into that status and like what kind of where you live. Internet quality is really important to look out for, because if somebody's internet is like a little bit fuzzy, they're going to sound less intelligent than somebody who's saying the exact same thing over quality that's really good and they're coming through clearly. And so there are all these new factors that don't exist when somebody walks into an office and just talks to you in a meeting room. And they're going to affect how people see candidates, because, you know, if the internet quality is not great or you can see their messy bed or whatever, those things don't matter. Like, they have nothing to do with how good of an engineer they're going to be. But you might subconsciously think like, oh, they're messy, they're not going to like keep the code base clean, or their internet isn't good, so they just don't sound as smart as they would if you were talking to them in person. There are all these things that play into interviews. And I think it's really important for people to be trained on looking out for that kind of stuff and recognizing that that might impact your opinion of somebody when you're interviewing them, so that you can try to minimize that as much as possible and give everyone a fair chance.
Is this something that you think we can train engineering managers and engineering leaders on to be able to kind of be more aware of it in the interviews? Or do you think it's something that there's just going to always be that bias and we'll never be able to remove it completely? Like, how, for instance, how do you remove it or try to remove it yourself?
Yeah, so it's not possible to remove any kind of bias completely. There's always going to be stuff that subconsciously is there and you're thinking about. But I think that pointing it out and saying this is something that's going to impact potentially how you think of someone, be aware of it, that is really useful. And I know when I started interviewing years ago, we had to go through all these trainings about how, you know, if you're talking to someone who's really young or really old or like this gender, like whatever it is, just being aware, like, hey, this might impact what you think of them. Try not to. Just knowing that makes it more likely that you'll think hard about, like, okay, they said this. Do I not like that because of the content of what they said? Or is it because of the context around it that is making me think this certain way? I think just knowing about that stuff goes a long way, and making that a part of interview training and interview refresher training is a good step to combat that.
I always wonder on this, because essentially what's happening in this scenario is you effectively have, as Alexandra pointed out, you effectively have more points of signal towards somebody that you just wouldn't have before. And one of the things that I constantly have conversations on with engineers, but even more, I guess, business leaders too, is a lot of people want to say something that kind of looks insightful, but ultimately doesn't matter. But they need to look insightful. And so they need to have that moment. And so the bias in this might be like, hey, I'm looking for something. I'm trying to pick up on a couple of different things. Ultimately, I think always along the way, somebody else has to be saying, does it actually matter? Like, because these things will come up in interviews. And I see it now, given I'm on the VC side, I constantly am interacting with VCs who will point out the dumbest things. Like, I loved this person because they did X. I hated this person because they did exactly the same thing, and they thought it led to a certain signal. None of those things ultimately likely matter, or the set of things that likely matter in those the outcomes of, you know, an adventure world or the, someone's ability to do their job are actually super small. And what are those? And I think people along the way in the processes need to ultimately call out BS on, does it actually matter? No, it probably doesn't. So remove it from your evaluation in all likelihood. But more than that, you got to like start doing that pre hoc, because people form their opinions based upon those. But you got to stop the process along the way too.
Yeah, I agree. I've had so many post-interview calls at previous companies where things were brought up like, oh, yeah, this person plays the same video game we do. They're going to get along great on the team. Or, you know, like, oh, they contributed to this library somewhere. Awesome. And just pointing out like, okay, but that doesn't really matter. Let's not put our decision on whether they should join the team based on these tiny signals that don't have any kind of indication on how they'll actually do on the job.
This goes way back for me, but about 6-7 years ago, I was building a company where we analyzed the source code of developers, and we looked at it in context of the code base that they would be working on at a company. And it did things like analyzing their experience, or, you know, with certain libraries, and looking at that in context of what the company was using, style of code, and a whole bunch of other factors. And what we found, which I found very interesting, is that the people who objectively, and again, this wasn't a perfect measure, but it was definitely able to capture quite a lot. We found that was like objectively often the best people for a certain role, or the ones that looked incredibly similar to the people that were already there. So this was like these high dimensionality vectors that had a whole bunch of characteristics about one person's code history versus the people who were working there, and it matched them. And what you were usually looking for was people who would fit in the code base, or people who would be like someone else on the team. Because that's often how we hire. Like, oh, we want another senior front-end engineer who looks like Janet because she's really great. And by the time it came for the companies to actually run the people through the interview process, and we were doing this with hundreds of companies, so the sample size wasn't small, they extremely rarely ended up hiring the people who objectively showed to be the best fit for their code bases or for the people they were hiring. Because there's so many human biases that we have that, like, at the end of the day, and when we run through an interview process, you know, we pick every person in, we throw an interview process with a different set of biases, right? So, and I think most of the time, none of us are even aware what our biases are. I recently had somebody who was telling me, like, oh, I really appreciate they went to this school, or that they showed up wearing a shirt with a collar. Two things to me that had absolutely zero, like, I mean, like, I didn't even think about it. And somebody else said, oh, their age. And I'm like, I've worked with them for 3 years. I don't know what their age is, right? And I for sure have my own biases, but they're not obvious to me. But other people's biases are obvious to me when they're so different to my own. And so I really wonder if, like, and this is maybe a much broader topic and probably for a whole episode, like, if at all we are just any good at hiring. We're somewhere probably within a spectrum of like random, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I think anyone who says they're good at hiring is lying. It's a gamble, because people can also be amazing at interviewing and awesome to talk to and do really well on like code tests and all that stuff. but you have no real way of telling how they're going to do on the job, because the job is so different from any interview process. Like, it's about how you collaborate with engineers and other teams, how you deal with like long projects, how you collaborate and like give code review feedback. Like, there's just so much to it that you can get signals for based on the interview, but you know, how you present yourself in an hour or two has no impact on how you're actually going to be to deal with over months and years. So yeah.
I agree entirely. I think that like basically we're at a random stage for hiring, and I think people will argue differently. But here's what I do think too, is that we confuse hiring as well as like remote and in person at different stages, because the type of person you're going to hire for a 5-person startup out of the gate likely looks different than a Microsoft sized person. You're going to be optimizing for different sets of traits, even though you're saying like we would like them to have each of these traits at each one of these stages, the depth at which they're going to have maybe one of those is going to be slightly different. So, you know, GitHub as an example, like, you know, the first 5 people likely look very different than the last 5 in the 2500 range. And yet they all worked at GitHub at various times. And it makes it very difficult, one, because most people don't have the intentionality of saying, what are we hiring for? Who are we hiring for? What are the traits we want out of these people? That's usually the first. They say, we need to go hire 5 engineers. 5 engineers that of what type of, who are doing what, who we want to slope grow into, that sort of thing. And then the other is, I find that most people tend to be really poor, again, at interviewing, because what they're looking for is they're just pattern matching. They're like, I liked this about them, which is literally the worst measure you could possibly do. I like a lot of people that I'm never going to want to work with. And I dislike a lot of people who I think would be actually excellent at their jobs. So you have to understand the balance of these things.
Jason, I'm going to throw a question at you, and I'll throw the same to you, Alexandra. Well, today it's invest. Before it was hire. But I'm going to ask you for both contexts. If you think someone's very good at what they do and you don't like them, would you hire them or invest in them?
So this obviously depends. I say this is kind of like a Travis Kalanick or Trevor Milton stage type of thing, or Adam Newman. If I dislike them and I think that they're an awful human who is going to go do things that are over lines, no, I won't. But if I dislike them because of their Twitter personality or something else that I think is different than mine, but it doesn't fall into the caustic range, then I likely would, because the job is not to find 1,000 people that I ultimately want to hang out with and have a beer, which is why I hate that test. The test is not what I want to have a beer with them. The test is, ultimately, is this company going to be better off? Are people around the table going to learn more from this person? Are people going to remember the influence from all these people? Are they going to make us a better place? And yes, there's some element of quote unquote like dislike that comes into that. But generally speaking, if you're 1,000 people, there are going to be many people in your organization who are excellent at their jobs that you dislike, and you're never going to be able to find a set of 1,000 people that all 1,000 people like. That is impossible to go do. So already, we already know that there's going to be subsets of people that we do enjoy hanging out with or not hanging out with, et cetera, et cetera. But then there are going to be people who you are okay professionally interacting with, and then you're never going to have another interaction with them. It's going to be through a PR. It's going to be through something else. So yeah, I would. Now, again, it depends, because now roles also become critically important too. So would I hire a VP who is unlikable, just completely unlikable by everybody in the organization or by the majority set of people? Well, maybe if the subset of people who I absolutely care enjoy this person's interaction. So like, let's say that, you know, I have an engineering organization of 100 people, and the 20 best performers absolutely love working with this style of person or this person's personality. And we have a whole bunch of people who are underperformers or whatever. I'm not optimizing for the 80. I'm optimizing for that 20 in this scenario because of what that organization needs for whatever reason. And again, like, this is a super nuanced topic, but the point being, it's not straightforward. Like, and that to me is like one of the most critical things you should remove from your organization.
I totally agree. The only thing I would add to that is I really like hiring people who specifically like don't necessarily mesh with my personality, because it's or we work well together, but complement each other. So, you know, hiring for skills that you don't have is always a good thing to do. But I also think that hiring people who don't have the same way of thinking as you and approach things from a very different perspective is really great. So like I love working with our CTO, Sam, because we are total opposites, where he's like thinking so strongly about like technology and code and like how to do things like that. And I'm thinking like product, people, process. And it's like, we'll have like different opinions of the same thing, but that kind of conflict is really good because that leads to the best decisions happening. So I love hiring for that kind of conflict.
This is the most important topic for me. And I've had this conversation with every boss that I've had for the last 10 years. And I have this conversation with my partners now at Redpoint and stuff, which is the, how are we going to fight conversation? Because the point is, we're going to disagree over stuff. And, you know, I happen to like my partners at Redpoint. And in the past, there, you know, I've had bosses who I've not liked at all. And I've had subordinates who reported to me, or team members and stuff, who I did not. But we had the conversation about how we're going to fight. And you can get through this if you understand that dynamic, but also tells you a lot about a person eventually if you realize what that interaction is going to be. And I can tell you almost, this is like the closest I can possibly get to a rule. The dirtier someone fights, the less likely I should have hired them, and the more likely we will fire them. And also, if you have a boss who fights kind of dirty and kind of mean in that way, there, that goes into the, I should not hire you, no matter how much I like you as a human. You are not a quality person. And that is like as universal as the rules I possibly will get to.
I like it. We need to label that. I'll have to think of a name, but I think it's a very, very good rule of thumb that universally will hold true. Alexandra, I know we're coming towards the end of the episode. Is there anything that you'd love to share with the engineering leaders that are listening to us as kind of final words today?
Yeah, my go-to advice, which I always fall back on and always have to relearn all the time, is to ask your team questions, even if you think the answer is really, really obvious and you know it, because I will have like the simplest question and it'll seem like the most obvious answer. And before acting on it, I'll think like, I'm just going to do a quick survey and like run this by the team, and I'll send something out and everyone will have just like absolutely totally different opinions than what I could have ever imagined. And it surprises me every single time for the smallest things. So I'm always trying to get people to like just ask your team as many questions as you can to really understand them and lead in a nice, like, kind of not democratic way necessarily, but like just really be aware of what your team is thinking is super important. So that's my like final words of wisdom.
I love those. Jason and I are smiling here for those who aren't watching it on video, because I think we both very much agree.
100%.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey to more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, tweet or DM us at devleadership_ on Twitter. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.com. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.